The next matter on our calendar is State of Minnesota versus Asempa. Good morning, Council. While you are getting settled, I'll just remind both of you of our procedures. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Council for Appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It is important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. You will see you each have a podium from which to deliver the argument. We are still trying to maintain some amount of physical distance out of an abundance of caution and to make people more comfortable. The lights are in the center podium, so we understand if you have to step back once in a while to check the lighting at the main podium, but so far it's worked pretty well. So please be seated, and when you're ready, Counsel for Appellant, you may proceed.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. I am just making sure I can connect to Wi-Fi.
Okay.
Should I need it?
Okay, thank you. All right, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, opposing counsel. Before I get into my argument, I just want to say what a pleasure it is to appear before this court. This is actually my first time appearing before this court, and it makes me really proud to be a female attorney in front of a panel of female attorneys and opposing counsel as a female. So, thank you.
And could you state your name just before
yes,
we get going?
Yes, I will. Thank absolutely. You. That was my next line. My name is Natalie R. Pauly. I represent the appellant in this matter, who is Ms. Akpani Yah Asempa, and the district court case was State v. Asempa. I am here respectfully asking this court to withdraw appellant's guilty plea and remand the case back to the district court for further plea negotiations or a trial, whichever she goes forward with her new attorney. And I'm praying for this relief of withdrawing her plea for two separate reasons. They are intertwined. The first reason is it is my position that the district court erred by denying appellant's motion to withdraw her guilty plea because appellant entered her guilty plea under ineffective counsel of her first attorney. That was the attorney when she pled guilty, and I'll be referring to him as attorney one. She currently has a separate attorney at the district level who went forward with the timely withdrawal motion. And that brings me to the second reason. It is my proposition that the district court erred in denying appellant's motion to withdraw her guilty plea because withdrawing her guilty plea prior to sentencing would have been fair and just based on the record before the district judge. And if the panel does not have a preference, I'd like to begin with that second portion, the fair and just standard. So Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 15.05 Subdivision 2 allows for an appellant to, a defendant at this level to withdraw her guilty plea if she makes a timely motion before she's sentenced, but after she pled guilty. And the standard is fair and just. And the district court looks at these two reasons together. The first prong is the reasons the defendant at that level gives, which is the appellant's burden in this case. And then the second is the prejudice to the state, which is the state's burden. And I'll be talking about the reasons the defendant, appellant Asempa, gave.
And we review this decision by a district court for abuse of discretion, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So I guess what I'm most interested in is your argument. In what way did the district court abuse its discretion in denying your client's motion?
Thank you, Your Honor. My position is the district court did not really address the first prong, the reasons the defendant put forward in this case. The district court's main reason was they agreed that there would be certain prejudice to the state, but it wouldn't be fair and more in a policy argument because it would be undermining the bargaining process, but that is not a factor in this fair and just standard. And
why isn't it? Why isn't just the maintaining the integrity of the judicial process and holding people to their counsel decisions part of the fairness and justice equation?
Yes, Your Honor. I would argue that it is and it isn't. It is in a more macro sense, that part of the criminal justice system is inherently that idea that not all cases will go to trial. And holding people to their guilty pleas when they are correct is proper. However, when you look at when they want to withdraw, that's when we shouldn't look at kind of the more macro, but more the micro of the case. What is fair and just to this appellant? And I think one of the reasons the district court did touch on that I don't think they fully fleshed out is the idea that this case had been going on for quite a long time. That is correct. However, I think there's one piece that was really missing in that analysis, and that was that there was an amended complaint filed by Ramsey County, in front of the Ramsey County District Court on September 5th, 2019. Appellant entered her plea of guilty on January 28th, 2020, but the decision to uphold those charges beyond the probable cause standard happened in December of 2019. So although on paper it may look like this case had taken a long time, there was really only 1 month between the new cases, the new charges, and when she entered the plea.
To be clear, counsel, though, the date that Ms. Asempa entered the plea was actually the date of her scheduled jury trial, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Right. So although you are correct in terms of reciting the procedural history and the amended complaint and the probable cause determination, this case had, in fact, been pending for quite a while and was at the point of an actual jury trial.
Yes, absolutely.
And that I'm struggling because one of your arguments, and maybe I'm jumping because this goes
absolutely
to a slightly different point, but one of your arguments is that Ms. Asempa did not appreciate, and this is really your ineffective assistance of counsel argument, that she did not appreciate that she was waiving her jury rights. And that is a hard one for me based on this record, because that's exactly why she was appearing in court that day, was for a jury trial. And there is express recognition of that in the waiver colloquy.
Yes, absolutely. I will, you are correct, Your Honor. She does explicitly state on the record she understands the plea petition and it goes by line. However, I think when we drill down to the actual transcript of the plea hearing, there is some wavering. And I think the district court acknowledged that wavering.
Well, the wavering was as to the factual basis, and you're not arguing on appeal that, I guess under your first argument, Your Honor, mm-hmm. not arguing on appeal that this guilty plea was invalid because it was inaccurate, are you? I think your argument is that it wasn't intelligent and voluntary because she didn't realize she was giving up her rights or felt coerced into doing so. But confirm with me, you're not challenging the factual basis.
I guess I am and I'm not, and I'll kind of split it up. I'm not challenging the idea that what she said on record was not true. I don't want to forfeit my client's argument in that her affidavit says she asserted her innocence to her counsel throughout the entire time. And so it's not that I'm saying that is the explicit reason, but that goes into the ineffective counsel. And I can loop back, the Strickland test, the first prong, is the ineffective counsel, does it fall beyond, below a reasonable objective standard? And
what record do you have of that, and what case are you relying on? Because we generally, with guilty pleas, hold people to what they're saying to the court under oath. And you're not saying that she was not mentally competent that day, or otherwise under duress. So help us out here.
Yes, Your Honor. No, I am not saying there wasn't anything going on behind the scenes. I am saying we should look at the transcript, and the transcript has issues in terms of the mens rea that I think her counsel should have picked up on, taken a step back, and either had a discussion with her or said, quite frankly, if you do believe you're innocent and do you not possess the mens rea, then you should not go in front of the judge and plead guilty.
But isn't that part of the plea petition to say I am not claiming innocence? I mean, that's part of the record, too, that she signed a plea petition in which she indicated she wasn't claiming innocence.
Yes, she signed a plea petition. In her affidavit that she submitted later, she states that her attorney filled out the plea petition and she signed it. And it's a little hard in this case in that we have a full-fledged record, but there is this black box of what happened between her and her attorney in that discussion.
But we also have as part of the record a January 21st, 2020 settlement or some sort of a pretrial conference when there was extensive negotiations going on. I think the open issue at that point had to do with licensing going forward and things like that. So, I mean, boy, doesn't that undermine your argument that she didn't fully understand what she was doing and knowingly and voluntarily waive her rights 1 week later?
I don't believe so, in that I know there was negotiations. I don't believe the record is clear if those negotiations are between client and attorney. I know they are for sure between state and defense in that, and there is a record saying there is back and forth, we've gone back and forth, but did that, oops, sorry. I just hit the microphone for the record. Did that trickle back down to the client? And I don't believe so because of her affidavit. And the attorney at that time did submit an affidavit, and he said this is what she's basically bringing up. However, he did not challenge that. And so I think with the fair and just standard, it's not just her plea allocution, but it's the whole record in general. And I think in the aggregate, it was fair and just to basically say, you have a new attorney whom you trust, why don't we take a second, go back, withdraw your plea, and have you go through the same process with an attorney who you trust. And I think, to get back to your policy point, I believe it helps micro on this level, that it helps her trust the system more, and it helps her, whatever the solution, whether that be trial or further plea negotiation, be happy and be confident and not have that buyer's remorse the district court touched upon, but also in the macro level, the public, however little or more they may be interested in this, I think it helps the public trust the system more when you say, you know what, I'm really not comfortable, I'm wavering on my plea, can I take a moment with this new counsel to go back? That's, and I know that's more of a policy argument. This court is not a policy court. I thought I would bring it back to that. To really hone in on Judge Bjorkman, your questions about the plea petition, I think what's an interesting point in this case is that she filed the plea petition and then she gets on the record and she has issues that go right against her plea petition, such as on the transcript, her attorney asks her, and you did in fact get paid for those claims that you submitted with incorrect names on them, over $5,000 of those claims, is that right? And I am quoting the transcript at January 28, 2020, and that's page 9 of my brief. Appellant says, not to my intent, yeah. That goes right to, does she understand what she's giving up and that mens rea, which is an essential element? He goes on to ask her, so you did know you submitted these claims to DHS, that some of those claims had different names on them than the timesheets that supported this claim. She states, not really, but that's what's being shown to me now. He says, so you would agree that the timesheets that supported your claims that you submitted to DHS had different names on them than the claims you submitted on some of them? Appellant, well, I'm not sure because everything has been confiscated. The rest, what I wrote down, I don't know what it is when my office was raided. The court steps in. Let me ask you a question. Why are you pleading guilty to theft by swindle? She answers, well, it's the best offer they've given me. And the court says, are you guilty? And she says, I guess, yeah. Later in the plea colloquy, the court and appellant both become frustrated. And I think there is a big disconnect in communication.
So, counsel, I'd have you be a little more pointed on that. So
yes.
If you go to the very next page, page 12, the district court actually says, I'm not going to accept a plea if she's not admitting she did anything. And then there is a second factual basis that
yes.
is laid by Mrs. Empa's counsel, I mean, with that counsel asking questions and Mrs. Empa responding. So, again, I don't read your brief as challenging the validity of the plea, so I don't know how germane how appropriate my question is, but what is the problem with the second factual basis that is laid? Because that's the one that was accepted by the district court, not the one that you just read out loud to us.
Yes, okay. And that is correct. The second issue is Mrs. Sempa, she becomes frustrated and she starts answering things, and the way she answers supports her affidavit later that she was pressured by ineffective counsel. For instance, he asks her a very lengthy question that I will not answer, but I will not read for the court for time. It starts with, so some of these cases, when work was done with PCA, and ends with, and then you submitted that claim to DHS, correct? Appellant, yes, yes, yes to everything.
Right, and the district court rejected that too, counsel. I mean, I'm a little frustrated with your argument because you are cherry-picking sections of a fairly long plea hearing, right? I mean, there were a lot of statements made by Mrs. Sempa, and the district court went back several times indicating that she, the district court, was not satisfied.
Yes.
And then Mrs. Sempa continued.
Yes, yeah. She did. Okay. And I think, Your Honor, I wholeheartedly agree with the transcript. She does allocute the facts. I think under the fair and just standard, when we pull it back a little bit, there is pressure not only from her counsel, but also from the court, in that the court tells her this is the last time in continuing this case. This is the last stop, which tells appellant that you're either going to trial or you're pleading guilty. And there is some sort of discussion between her and her attorney. There is, and I see my time is running up. May I finish this point?
You may finish answering that
question. Okay, thank you. There is a discrepancy between how long they actually discussed it. The attorney says an hour. She says 15 to 30 minutes. I don't think that one point raises to ineffective counsel. But I think with her affidavit saying what happened within that time does bring it in the aggregate to ineffective, and it would be fair and just to bring it back with a new attorney. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Jillian Free, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. This case is all about, as the district court properly put it, buyer's remorse. Appellant entered into a guilty plea and is now regretting that decision and is doing anything in her power to undo that. The first way she attempts to do that is through claiming she had ineffective assistance of counsel. However, appellant has not met her Strickland burden to show that she received ineffective assistance of counsel. To prevail, appellant must prove two elements on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and this is important. First, that counsel's representation fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, which appellant argues but does not satisfy, and second, that there's a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the results of the proceeding would have been different, which appellant doesn't argue at all, forfeiting this issue entirely.
Well, isn't it obvious in a case where the claimed ineffectiveness is entering a guilty plea when you're not guilty that the course of action would be going to trial? I mean, they were there for trial, and had she not received this ineffective assistance, why wouldn't that meet the second element?
Your Honor, that's not argued before the briefs that appellant filed, but I would also say that trying to take back a plea after a plea is entered is not accepted by this court, or every defendant would do that in every case. And as the judge alluded to at the district court, that would just draw on the case forever. It'd basically be continuance after continuance, which in this case there was already 9 continuances, and the case had been with the district court for almost 3 years, which is an extremely lengthy period of time. What's important to note, and I think Judge Siegel alluded to this, is that we begin with the strong presumption that counsel provided reasonable assistance, and that burden's extremely difficult to overcome. You know, there wasn't some form of incapacity here in this case that was alluded to, and I think what's key is that an unreasonable attorney's representation amounts to incompetence, not just a mere deviation in attorney tactics or prevailing professional norms. First, appellant claims that she was never informed of various things, her right to a jury trial, the outcomes of what a jury trial could be, what she was pleading to, the consequences of pleading to that, the rights she was giving up. But as all of Your Honors had indicated, under oath when reviewing the plea petition, she waived all of those issues. She said she did understand all of those, answered affirmatively that she went over all of those things with her attorney, both in the plea petition and again before the court while sworn in under oath. Next, appellant claims that she had insufficient time to discuss the plea with her attorney, and this is just simply not true. Appellant claims in her affidavit that she had between 15 and 30 minutes, and then the judge indicates that there was about an hour and a half to 2 hours there that they had between when the case was first called and then when the plea was entered. And then Mr. Jellinger, the attorney in question here, in his affidavit, he said that he spoke to his client immediately before the plea for 60 minutes. Additionally, I think it's important to note that appellant had 5 months to consider the offer before she pled guilty due to the length of this case and when the offer was first put on the record before appellant and her attorney. Appellant claims that her attorney discarded evidence that she told him would corroborate her innocence claim and that she felt pressured into accepting the deal to avoid jail time. Well, first, appellant agreed that she made no claim that she was innocent within the plea petition and again before the court. And second, appellant offered no legal or factual evidence as to her claims of innocence. So the district court correctly concluded that appellant had buyer's remorse about her plea, which the district court said was common and understandable.
Doesn't the difficulty of getting this plea in, the factual basis part of the plea, we've all read the transcript. I mean, wouldn't that be supportive on some level of the claim that she was in fact innocent? And was not pleading guilty voluntarily?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I know she did waver a little bit, but then the district court did a very thorough job of going back in and basically having her admit to all the facts a second time. It's a lengthy plea petition, I think 19 pages. And so when the district court thought there may be some wavering there, she did a very thorough job of going in and making sure that appellant did understand exactly what she was giving up, exactly what was happening. So I would say that that's not applicable here. I think she did know. And additionally, it's important to look at appellant. I mean, she's an educated woman. She had a college degree, and at the time of sentencing, she was enrolled in a master's program and a doctorate program and held a nursing license. So she's a very intelligent woman. I think she completely understood what was happening. And, you know, as the district court said, she just has some buyer's remorse. As her attorney at the district court alluded to, she was probably going to lose her career due to this being on her criminal record, so it's understandable.
In her affidavit, she talks about the fact that, or she claims her attorney threatened her that she would go to jail right away if she didn't take the plea. Is this a presumptive commit offense that she was charged with, or is there anything in the record about that?
Your Honor, I think in the record, the district court did say, and I'm just going to quote it here, it's from the January 29th, 2021 hearing on page 11, the only way she was going over with appellant's attorney that she did understand what the jail implications actually were here. And the district court said the only way for her to avoid prison and be blocked in on avoiding prison is based on a plea. Based on these charges, if convicted, she's looking at prison. And so the district court did affirm, you know, the only way to promise no prison time is by this settlement offer with the state and this guilty plea right here. If you're before a jury and found guilty, you're going to go to jail. So appellant was aware of that, and the judge clarified that. But I will say, talking about appellant's affidavit, this court gives deference to the credibility determinations made by a district court during a plea hearing, and the district court did not find appellant's affidavit, quote, compelling, end quote. And the district court stated that, and I'm going to quote this, I don't believe that Mrs. Sempa is being completely honest with the court, which is part of the reason that the court denied her motions that were previously filed. Therefore, this court should not disturb the district's court finding that appellant's claims are not credible. Moving on to the second prong of the ineffective assistance claim, there's no reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different. And I already touched on that a little bit, so I'll move on. I do think it's important to note for the record, ineffective assistance generally should be raised in a petition for post-conviction relief rather than on direct appeal, and that was not done here. However, appellant's allegations are so unsupported and unpersuasive that any petition would fail as a matter of law. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has said, although we ordinarily remand for further proceedings in post-conviction court, in light of specific facts, the interests of judicial economy can be served by considering the merits of appellant's claims. And that's true here today. Next, and I'll do this very quickly, is the fair and just standard for withdrawing a guilty plea. An appellant said before the court earlier this morning that the district court didn't address the first issue of fair and just, and I would disagree. I mean, the district court didn't only address that it was not fair and just, but she also addressed that under the manifest injustice standard, which is a higher burden, it also was not able to withdraw the guilty plea under that standard, which she did not need to do that analysis at all. So, first, the reasons that she advances to support plea withdrawal are that the district court found appellant was aware of her rights when she made her plea and admitted to a factual basis to support her plea. We touched on that with her education and her background. She knew what she was doing. Second, appellate claims she's innocent, but this court has said innocence proclaimed after entering a plea is not significant reason to withdraw a plea. Again, we've touched on that. And then she said she felt pressured to plead guilty, but again, that's not relevant here. The Minnesota Supreme Court has held that the bare assertion a defendant felt pressured to plead guilty without further evidentiary support does not provide a fair and just reason for plea withdrawal. The second element here under the fair and just standard, and then I'm almost done, Your Honors, is prejudice granting the motion would have on the state. However, if defendant fails to satisfy her burden of showing fair and just reasons for withdrawing the plea, this doesn't need to be discussed at all. Here, appellant failed to meet her burden to show fair and just reasons to demonstrate plea withdrawal was appropriate, so it's unnecessary for this court to assess any prejudice that the state would have had. Appellant's attorney at sentencing said that her nursing career would be harmed greatly by this, and she'd have to get a job in a whole new field. So it's understandable that she has buyer's remorse about entering this plea, and the district court correctly concluded that appellant should not be able to withdraw her guilty plea, and she did not abuse her discretion for sure. Unless this court has any other additional questions, I would ask that this court affirm the district court.
Questions? I see none. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Pauley, you will have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. I'd just like to touch on a couple things respondent argued for, and they're going to be mainly factual, so I apologize for any tedious nature. The first is, I want to make clear that the abuse of discretion is met when a district court goes against the logic or the facts of the record. So that is why I'm concentrating on the facts. There's a couple things respondent brought up in her argument as to why this was buyer's remorse and that she knew what she was getting into. That's appellant. Firstly, the concept that she was going to prison if she entered trial and the only way out of it was this specific plea deal bolsters the argument that she didn't really understand what was happening and she was pressured by her attorney to take this plea. And it goes with the colloquy where she states, this is the best offer given to me. Secondly,
That's okay. Don't we need actually something in the record telling us that? I mean, where is it in the record?
Sorry, can you clarify what you're asking?
Yeah,
for the record?
You just said that she didn't understand that she thought she was going to jail, etc., and that her lawyer, you know, was incorrectly advised her. And if I'm putting words in your mouth, but where is that in the record that we can look at?
I would thank you, Your Honor. I would say that is in her affidavit that she submitted under oath, that he said he was fearful for her life and that if she did not accept this, she was going to be taken into jail immediately. But if she answered yes to all the questions, she would go home that day, which is what happened. Unfortunately, there was much more collateral consequences. And I think rightly regret from this. I don't think it was buyer's remorse regret. And that brings me into my second factual point, is that appellant is a very educated woman, and her master's and doctorate is in nursing, so it's illogical on the record that she would enter a plea that would strip her of this career that she's investing time and money in throughout this plea process. And I know that's kind of a convoluted argument, but it doesn't make sense logically. And I think that's something that the district court should have looked into when it was looking in that fair and just standard. And then finally, the reason at its core why we're asking the court to withdraw the plea offer and bring it back to the district court is I don't think there was analysis on the fair and just and prejudice to the state. And if I could just have a moment, I have the... I want to make sure I quote the memorandum correctly, or the order, excuse me. The order on page 5 of that, after the judge goes through the manifest injustice standard, she then enters the fair and just standard. And here's the entire analysis. It would not be fair and just to allow defendant to withdraw her plea.
Thank you.
I think that is a problem because...
Well, the court goes on. I mean, in all fairness, there's a whole paragraph of explanation. I mean, and the court acknowledges, no, there's not going to be a lot of prejudice to the state here, but allowing your client to withdraw her guilty plea in the context of this record would undermine the process under which plea agreements are reached. And then the court goes on to talk about how your client understood her rights and that the district court did not find your client's affidavit compelling. So what's lacking in the fair and just analysis as expressed by the court in that paragraph?
Yes, Your Honor, and I did not make offense to the district court. She does analyze it. What I meant and what I incorrectly stated was that first prong of the reasons defendant put forward, that's really not analyzed here. She does analyze the prejudice to the state, simply saying she doesn't find the defendant's affidavit to be compelling, I don't think meets the standard of analysis. I think if she did not find it compelling, there needs to be more analysis of why, because there's no argument against her attorney in the otherwise. And I see my time is coming to an end. If there's any more questions.
Anything further?
Okay.
Seeing nothing. Thank you,
Thank you, Your Honors. I very much appreciate the opportunity to argue.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.